Hello, everybody, and welcome to another season. That's right, another season of Modern Day Philosophers. This is the first episode of season 4. I'm excited to be doing it. Thank you for being here. Thanks for tuning in. If you're new, welcome to the show. I hope you like it. I hope you love it. I hope it's the best show you've ever discovered for you. Why shouldn't I have high hopes? And if you've been with the show for a long time, thank you for staying with the show. I appreciate it. I appreciate having you on board. Welcome back. Welcome back. When I started out doing this show, I had in my head, let me see if I could get through one season. And once I got through one season, my goal was, let me see if I could get through 5 seasons. So now we're on season 4. I'm not saying the show will be over after 5 seasons. Maybe it'll, you know, I'll extend it again in my head and see, let me see if I can get through another amount of seasons. But I feel really good that we're getting close to that 5th season either way. It's a lot of work for me to do this show. You know, I schedule the interviews, I do the interviews, I edit the interviews, I post the interviews, I promote the interviews, and, you know, I'm lucky to have Alex and Logan. You know, Logan masters the audio and Alex comes up with the philosophers, but that's the whole team, and it is a lot of work, and I'm not complaining about it. I'm happy to do it, but I'm also excited about the fact that I've been able to continuously do it for this long, and I haven't given up. And I've been consistent about it. And I'm excited about that. That's a big achievement for me. I'm a guy who starts a lot of things and has had a hard time in the past completing them and finishing them and seeing them through. Lots of diets come to mind, trying to lose weight. And I've been, you know, gung-ho out the gate, and then it fizzles out into nothing. And I was worried that would happen with the show, and it hasn't. And by the way, as we start season 4, I also start an eating disorder program that I enrolled myself in, and I got medical clearance, and they gave me a nice sliding scale for performer, I guess, for a low-income person, so I'm able to afford it. And this has been my first week in the program. It's very intense. It's coming at it from a different perspective than things I've done in the past, where I've gone to dietitians and nutritionists and went on, you know, Weight Watchers or this or that. This is a team of therapists that are trying to help tackle it emotionally. See, like, what is that void I'm trying to fill? Try and get through it that way. And having been through 1 week, I'm very optimistic that this could work, because I haven't felt that emptiness this week so much. I've been doing really well. I've been doing well with depression. I've been doing well with eating. And I think that's also why a lot of people go on diets and they put all the weight back on afterwards, is because they're not really tackling the problem. They're just patching it up. So I'm assuming that's the philosophy behind the program I'm in, though I haven't actually outright asked them. I think that's probably where they're coming from. Makes sense. Stands to reason. And they also give you nutrition. There's also a nutritionist, but there isn't a diet per se. They're just telling you, stay away from this if you can, stay away from that. And it puts the power in the patient's hands, in my hands, and it makes me not want to eat those things. Not because I have to not eat them, but because I've been educated better than that with the nutrition. So I feel like I'm telling you all this stuff and you're like, wow, that's pretty great. And then I'm so worried that next week I'll be like, you know, didn't work for me. I'm terrified of that, but I hope not. I'm really trying, and I intend to succeed, so I don't know. More than that, I can't tell you. It's an addiction. Eating is an addiction, and it's addiction, I think, is at the root. There's some kind of, I think it's partially genetic, and I think it's also partially an emotional deficiency of some sort. So I'm trying to figure out what that is in me, and trying to get to the core and the root of the problems, work out everything, and come out of it a new man. That's my plan anyway. Better myself. Live. Stay alive. See how that works out. And I've been pushing hard to get good interviews for the show. Working really hard at it. I went to a Q&A with Larry David the other night with a friend of mine. I was like, this could be my chance. I always wanted to interview Larry David. It was like, it's always been a dream of mine. And to get him on this show, I thought would be fantastic because, well, he's a philosophical dude. His show references philosophy quite a bit. His most recent movie on HBO, Clear History, was centered around an Ayn Rand theme. I thought this would be a good fit. And I got an incredible introduction from somebody close to him. And it didn't seem to do very much. When the opportunity came in, I said, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to ask him. And I said, Mr. David, I'd love for you to do my show. It's a philosophy podcast, and I match a philosopher with a comedian every week, and I think you'd really enjoy it, and I would love to have you on it. And he looked at me, did that eye thing, that in Curb Your Enthusiasm, the stare down. He stared. It was very uncomfortable. He stared into my eyes, and then I felt uncomfortable, and I started listing off. I said, you know, well, Shelley Berman's done it, and I've done it with a few others, Lewis Black. It's a really good show. And he's looking at me, and he goes, nah. I go, no? He goes, nah, you can't have everything. And I didn't really know what to reply to that. I go, well, you could try. And he smiled, and he goes, yes, you can try. And I said, so it's an affirmative no? He goes, a definitive no? I go, that's what I meant, a definitive no? He goes, yes, it's a definitive no. I go, okay, thanks. And I did feel a bit deflated. I did feel like, man, I could feel like he was really considering it. I thought he was maybe going to say yes, and that would have been tremendous for me. But it didn't happen. It was a definitive no. I'm not going to give up on this dream, though. I do think there's still a possibility that somewhere down the line he might change it to a definitive yes. You never know. And that's what living is, I think. It's just not giving up and not taking no for an answer. If there's one thing I learned from the Muppets, Jim Henson, when they went to New York, they said, you can't take no for an answer. No, no, no. I think that's really the answer to show business. It's the only reason I've been able to survive as long as I have, is that I just refuse to take no for an answer. And it's all thanks to Jim Henson and his crazy sock puppets. All right. Here we go. This show, it's a great show. It's a wonderful, wonderful guest. Larry Miller, one of my favorite comedians, somebody who I've had the privilege of interviewing before on my old show, Comical Radio, many years back, and it was a thrill then, and it was a thrill now. And we recorded this on, like, the hottest day in the LA heat wave, and I don't have air conditioning, so you'll hear about that. Before we get to it, I want to tell you that I am lucky, and I am happy to have sponsors today for the show. One of them being somebody who I've always told you is very, very close to my heart, and I mean that sincerely, Mr. Dan Schlissel, the founder, the head, the brains behind Stand Up Records, the very label that released my CD, Some Kind of Comedian. That's right, Stand Up Records has launched a fantastic online store at standupcrap.com. That's www.standupcrap.com. You can go there. You can buy downloads. You can buy CDs, vinyl records, DVDs, shirts, and a wide variety of other merchandise is on its way direct from one of the best and most prolific comedy labels out there. Visit right now. Pause the show and visit standupcrap.com today. Go check them out. Pick up some comedy. We also have another wonderful sponsor, a listener of the show. And I can't tell you how touching it is when a listener sponsors an episode of the show. First of all, I live off of these sponsorships. There's no two ways about that. It's not a secondary income. It is an income. So it's how I survive. It's how I live. And I appreciate that when a listener decides to keep me going, it means I feel like I'm doing something right. The people are keeping me going. They're keeping me doing the show. And that means a whole lot to me. This comes from a man named Tim Chismar. And he says, what do you get when you combine Discovery's hit TV show, Naked and Afraid, with the classic sci-fi hit, Predator? You get Naked Alien Massacre. That's right, that's what you get. It's the latest cult film from writer-director Tim Chismar. It's starring professional wrestlers, classic scream queens, and real-life nudists, all fighting to stay alive from clothes-hating aliens. These aliens hate clothes. all being shot in a real nudist resort with two-time Oscar-winning FX team and Emmy Award-winning editors in production. There is still time to get involved and make a difference. They have a Kickstarter campaign going at Kickstarter.com. You can go right now. You could search for Naked Alien Massacre, and you can pick your awesome reward to help them make history. The Naked Alien Massacre. Finally, an original horror movie with balls. I like that. Well, there you go. Man, we got talented listeners. We got a dude making a nudist alien massacre movie. Tim Chismar, go support that. Go and jump on that Kickstarter. I really feel like we could build a supportive community of artists here, and not just artists, of people. Just, we could build a supportive community where we help each other, and I think that'd be great. Tim was kind enough to help me keep this show going. I put out the message, you go and you help Tim with his project, and it all becomes one big thing. It becomes one big collective of creativity, and that's pretty cool, I think. All right. Donate to the Kickstarter. Go to standupcrap.com. You can go and pick up my album there, Some Kind of Comedian. You can pick up albums from many of the guests you've heard, Brendan Burns, Mark Maron, Lewis Black, and Maria Bamford. Go to standupcrap.com. And now, without further ado, we kick off season 4 with my guest, the wonderful Mr. Larry Miller, right after the intro song. Enjoy, everybody.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
I'm just loving sitting down in a nice chair and seriously relaxing.
Good. Okay. Well, I'll take a drink of this coffee and then we'll get started.
Okay.
The Mormons will never know how good this is.
I think they do.
The coffee?
Oh, coffee.
Yeah. What do you think, chairs?
Just life in general.
Yeah, we had some Mormons, to the listeners, we had some Mormons in here a minute ago. I don't know if I'll use any of this, but in case I do.
Sure you do. People should know, that's, if they ever want to ask, so what is show business? Then I could tell them. I could tell them before I came here. But since coming here, now I know what to tell them. But it's true. It's how we all are. I walked in. We said, hello, good to see you. And walked up your path. And you said, we have a couple of Mormons here.
Yeah.
Who were going door to door. And we were the ones who opened the door. Yeah. And I think that's great. I think, as I told them, I think it's neat that they, as part of what they do, they have to go on the road, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they do that. They got a shirt and a tie on a hot day. And one guy had a hooded jacket. It's going to take a long time before I ever bring myself to say hoodie. But he had a hooded jacket. So they were nice. They're already inside here having the best day they're ever going to have. You gave them a pack of chewing gum.
Yeah.
Pack of graham crackers.
That's right.
And a couple of other things to eat that really sound good. They're terrible, of course, but I mean that doesn't matter. And so as they were leaving, after I came in, we all chatted for a bit. They got up to leave, and they also had to be careful not to step on either of the two dogs, one of whom looks like the lead in a not-for-kids movie. Well, like a violent, you know.
Oh, okay, yeah, like a...
I mean, the dog, he's a sweet guy. He's a great dog.
The pit bull, she...
Yeah, but no one has told him that he's a killer.
She. Yeah.
Maybe that's no one has told. Maybe killed. That's the reason.
Yeah.
But it's great to see two dogs like that, and there was a tortoise on the floor in the living room.
Yeah.
Who was alive, but you had to look at it until he... Finally moved that head about a quarter of an inch, because otherwise it could have been something from a garage sale. But I mean these in very positive ways.
Yeah.
So these two fellas who were going door to door to talk to people, I guess, and give them a pamphlet and get them started to be converted, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And at any rate, they got more out of this house than they were ever going to see. And your girlfriend is there eating cereal.
That's right.
And
you got a chicken running around.
There's a chicken in the back, right?
Yeah.
And that's, I might say to people, that's showbiz. And your other friend is a film director, and he's working on his script right now.
Yes.
On his laptop right now, in between the two fellows who knocked on your door.
Yeah.
And the only response to that is to say to people, number one, this is show business. What's show business? This. And in a good way. Hang on, but it's my sister calling. Hello, Cheryl? Hi, listen. I love you, but I'm on the air right now. I'm on a podcast right now, and this is the kind of thing you can do. I have headphones on, in fact, so I can't really hear you talk. So let me call you as soon as I finish this, okay? Well, couldn't hear that, but I love you. I'll speak to you right after this. Bye. And by the way, the beauty, one of the beauties, I think, of podcasting is, no matter how you edit this, you could leave that call in. And people would think, boy, that's kind of interesting. No one's ever actually answered a phone before. Wallace does that. George Wallace, the comic?
Yeah, I know. I knew who you meant.
He does that in his shows, and he does big shows.
Right.
With thousands of people in it. He means it completely. He says, if you have cell phones on you, and you're worried about them going off, let them go off. Don't turn them off. Let them ring. And if they ring, answer that. You don't want to miss that call. You don't know who it is. He says, I have the phone on and I answer it when it goes off. When our, and which is completely true. When we have a friend, Richard Jenny, who died. And it's about 3 years ago, I guess, 4 years ago. And he's a great comic. And well, he took his own life. He killed himself. But funny thing, people don't mention that much afterwards. For years later, they say, oh, he died on this date. She died on this date. Well, right. There's more to it than that. But at any rate, when I heard my wife called me, I was on the road, and it was just in between shows. I was upstairs in the hotel room, and she called me and said, hey, Richard Jenny just died. He just, you know, it was a terrible thing. He killed himself. And I said, how'd you find out? And she said, Wallace called you. And I said, oh, all right. When she said, call him back. Here's his number. Here's where he is now. And I called him back, and he answered, and we talked for a couple of minutes, and he was on stage. It was in the middle of one of his shows.
Wow.
And he wound up saying, they said, well, listen, I'm on stage now. I should, you know, let's talk afterwards. And I said, you're on stage now? We were just talking.
Would you do that? Would you take a call in the middle of a show?
No, I wouldn't have my phone with me.
Yeah.
God forbid it would be ever something bad like that, but I mean, no.
He sounds like one of the, maybe George Wallace, before becoming a comedian, was at a job where they didn't let him answer his phone, and he's like, this will never happen again.
You know what? That's valid. It could possibly be.
Yeah.
I just love, Wallace is one of those people you just love at, no matter what he does. He's just, our nickname for him, when we all started out, our nickname used to be the host of life. And that's what he is. He's the host of life. But at any rate, we talked. And so in any case, that's what podcasting can be.
Yeah, that's rough. I like, by the way, I never thought about it till you said took his own life. I think that's a very funny way of saying killed himself. Because it seems a little backwards, right? He left his own life. He wouldn't have took it, right?
Well, it's a good question. But I think the other way on this. I like when phrases are slightly more lyrical or more poetic. I like saying that when someone has died, I like saying, well, she passed on.
Mm-hmm.
I like passing on. I like the phrase passing on.
Just because it's softer?
No, it's because I think it reflects something I believe anyway. That was amazing.
Thank you.
The only air coming in the room on a desert day.
We got that air, but the chirping was coming through too strong, I thought. A lot of sparrow chirping.
Well, I'll buy that. This is your studio.
Yeah.
I might once again disagree.
If you feel too hot, we'll open it again.
But if.
If. Do you?
I feel like I'm in an interrogation in World War II.
I'm sorry.
If.
I'll reopen it.
No, it's all right. And this is another part of show business, by the way.
One day I aspire to have air conditioning. I perspire to have it. Anyway, it's wonderful to have you here, Larry. And we've talked before about the fact that we're both Long Island kids. And
that's right.
You being from Valley Stream, only a few train stops on the Long Island Railroad away from Long Beach. Actually, Valley Stream is about as far as you can go from Long Beach before they check your tickets.
That's exactly right, because Valley Stream is right over the New York City line. It's right on the border of Queens. But the Long Island Railroad was always... I remember their slogan, the route of the dashing commuter. That was it, wasn't it?
Before my time.
Oh, okay. But they used to have... That was a big thing. After World War II, all these people building new communities
mm-hmm.
in all over Long Island. And guys, I remember hearing that the young husbands, they would have, well, way out like in Levittown, all over Long Island, you know, close, far out, way out there. And these guys would have, many of them, 2.5-hour train rides each way to get to their jobs in New York and then to get home again. And they did it. They never shirked their duty and what they were there for. And I remember they used to play cards on the train. Each one had in his little insurance company suitcase there, well, they weren't little, but each one had a board with hooks and hinges on it, and all four guys would bring them out when they started that train trip, and they'd hook them together, and they would play cards on that, whether it was bridge or gin or anything. They'd play cards for 2.5 hours.
Those are dashing commuters. I think what happened with time is they became drunken commuters.
Yeah.
And I think they replaced the card games with 40s in paper bags.
Come to think of it, you know, you're right. There was no... People could smoke anywhere on those trains, but there also became smoking cars, not because of rules, and drinking cars. They used to have bar areas there in one of the cars.
I think in general, the whole idea of travel used to be much more prestigious than it is today. People used to get dressed up for a plane ride, for instance, right? And
that's right.
And now nobody cares, you know?
That's exactly right. And as we all know, when you see a documentary about baseball in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, everyone in the stands is wearing a suit. Every guy has a suit and a hat on and a tie. Why? Boy, you got me, but they all did.
What do you attribute it to? Do you think people just care less?
Well, today, yes. But, you know, it's something we've all taken ourselves through. But in those days, whatever, you can put that in quotes, whatever those days means. Well, sure, it was. I mean, heck, in the Old West, put that in quotes too, whatever that means. You know, you see them wearing vests in all the Westerns like Gunsmoke and Have Gun, Will Travel. Hey, he's wearing his vest. No one ever questioned that. I never questioned that.
Yeah.
But then you think, why vests? Why a vest? Well, it was because it was way hotter than it is with the window closed.
Yeah.
And they were very hot, so they take the main suit jacket off
mm-hmm.
and then unbutton the vest and put a sheriff's star on it.
They wanted something that would be prestigious, like a suit jacket, but they didn't want all that arm heat. I guess that the arm heat... I don't even think your arms... Do you ever feel like your arms are hot?
Right now, yes. But you know what? But I know in New York City, in the New York Historical Society, which is set up, well, they have great looks back at when the Dakota was being built in 1872 and what the whole city looked like. It's really wonderful stuff. And there are pictures, a lot of them of how Broadway looked up on the Upper West Side. And this is a shot from 1888 or 1901. And you can see it was taken. The guy went up into a building somewhere and took a picture. And you see everyone walking on the streets. And everyone, every single man, has a suit on. And these are tweed suits. A hat not even a cap, but like a bowler hat or a Stromborg hat, whatever that, you know, regular big hats, and an overcoat. And it wasn't a light overcoat. It wasn't a thin material overcoat. It was an overcoat, one of those Road to Perdition coats, mm-hmm. where it's about an inch and a quarter thick in the material. Every single guy in that picture is wearing those. And then you see on the bottom of the picture, and it, when it was taken, which is August 14th, 1902.
Yeah.
August 14th.
Yeah.
In Manhattan, on the Upper West Side, it was easily 110 degrees.
I think you just discovered the reason why there's so much more obesity now. People aren't sweating as much. It's the clothes.
You know something? That may actually be. That's funny. But yeah, people to wear things like mm-hmm. that. Oh, you don't have to open the window.
I feel bad. The sparrows seem to have calmed down.
You don't
have
to feel bad. You should feel bad, but you don't have to.
Right.
You know what, though? I remember as a kid in elementary school, on Thursdays, every single Thursday, we had assembly day. So they'd bring everyone into the assembly room. Every single kid knew it was dress-up day. So every single kid in elementary school, every boy had a white shirt and a tie on. Now, they could be short-sleeve white shirts, but your mom still had to take you to Gimbel's or someplace to get a white shirt. And they weren't expensive, but in those days, so they were $7 or $8 for a white shirt and get you a tie, too. And no one ever complained. No one ever said, yee, you know, we don't have a lot of money. We're a poor family. Every boy had a white shirt and tie.
You know who hurt the worst out of this has got to be the old Jews in the garment district who made all those suits. They must have lost so much market share when the Chinese came in with the t-shirts and everybody started wearing t-shirts instead of suits.
It's a good point. And you know what? I have a feeling. Who knows how markets change? And I'm sure in a huge way.
This is the beginning of China taking over America. They got us out of the suits into the t-shirts. And
it's the beginning, but not the end. And by the way, when you get the suit, they give you a fortune cookie too. But you know what? Who knows where those clothes came from and who bought them? Everyone had them.
Mm-hmm.
Even the poorest family, like Jewish families on the Lower East Side, mm-hmm. around 1900, 1910, 1920. The poorest families in walk-up apartments, and still the men wore the black tweed suits and the black overcoats and the black hats and huge beards.
And they'd wear them to the beach. I see pictures. It's true. I've seen pictures
I know.
Of old Long Beach. Everybody was dressed like they went going to a banquet, but they're going to the... Maybe people just didn't know how to dress back then. Everybody never knew the difference between a formal and casual attire. They thought always formal. Then everyone went always casual. And eventually, as we progress and evolve as human beings, we'll figure out the right ratio of formal to casual attire. Maybe that's where we're headed.
Maybe.
I still like to dress up when I fly because it gives me a feeling like I'm an international spy or something, you know?
Well, that's also... For us as comics, you know, it's
yeah.
We're a little out of our minds anyway, so it's possible you really do think maybe I do look like an international spy.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean. And it's a little different with planes today because if you're not flying first class and if you're in coach, you're kind of jammed in there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no fun. You don't feel elegant and no one next to you feels elegant either.
Well, they've stripped all the elegance away, not just with how small the seats are, but just by every little part of it being, you know, you got to pay for the extra bag, you got to pay for the meal.
Right.
Even from when I was a kid till now, I remember a plane, they used to bring you a beautiful meal and everything, and you felt like somebody just because you were on a plane.
That's exactly right. And with a nice cloth underneath it, mm-hmm. Sort of a nice elegant napkin underneath the tray, and then a tray with the meals. It didn't matter. Every time people would say, oh, it was just airplane food today. And even before this happened, I used to say, I had a bit about this in my act, I should bring it back, about how, you know what? There's a whole industry that made that meal for you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty good, isn't it? And they'll say to you, do you want the meat, chicken, or fish? Or you can order a vegetarian meal. And you know what? I used to say and really believed you're going to miss that when it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And when you don't feel like a high-class adult who happens to be taking a plane, you feel like, well, you know, a bum in steerage.
It's because they've stripped away the whole middle class. It's just, now it's just for first class and lower class. And that's basically the whole feeling of this whole country. You're either poor. I feel poor. I am poor. But most of the time, I feel poor.
Well, that's why you feel poor.
Yeah.
I can't figure it out, but I feel poor. Well, you're poor.
But because
they
don't give you much in terms of, you know, these moments when you'd have something that's with elegance. They really don't give you any moments where you're allowed to feel like you're not poor anymore.
Right. And ironically, though, it's the coach passengers who have to pay for their luggage. They get you for $25 there. And I understand from the airline's perspective, it's hard for them to make any dough.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not a way to run an airline. You really have to make people feel better than that.
Yeah.
And want to take your airline again and feel like someone when they go on the plane. So they don't have to get on a line that looks like you're in Soviet Russia in the 50s waiting for toilet paper.
Absolutely. It's actually reversed. I think when people used to fly, they used to really feel like someone, like you're saying. And that's now right. When you fly, you feel like less of someone than when you're not flying.
That's exactly right. They used to feel like someone. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, I always felt sporting events were great, because they brought people together on one level of class and they could all relate on that. And it doesn't matter whether, that's why people didn't have boxes that are closed in there to have buffets in them. Well, you go get a hot dog like anybody else. And it was nice that way, though.
I love equalizing moments. Like, one reason I like going to temple on Shabbat is because I'm there, the guy sitting next to me, he might be poorer than me, and the other guy sitting next to me might be a millionaire, but in that moment, we're all equal.
That's
I
right.
like this moment. You know, I have tremendous respect for you as a comedian and
thank you.
And your accomplishments but in this moment our lives are exactly the same.
Exactly the same, and we're both really hot.
Yes, I'm probably a little hotter just because I'm heavier. But
yeah, probably, but maybe not.
No?
No, I'm just being silly about it.
You're going to challenge how hot I am?
Yeah. Whenever someone says to me, "Boy, it was hot today, wasn't it?"
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, how would you know? You woke up in your house, which is completely air conditioned
mm-hmm.
from units outside the house. And so you wake up, it's 67, and you feel fabulous. You have breakfast, get in the shower, get dressed for work. Then you go down, get in your car, which is air conditioned. The air conditioned car takes him to an air conditioned office.
Mm-hmm.
And the fancy parking lot is air-conditioned, too. And after that, if he has time, he may leave his air-conditioned office
right.
at 5 or 6 o'clock and go get an air-conditioned beer with a couple of his buddies. And then go home in his air-conditioned car and go back to his air-conditioned house. So it's not possible he ever knew how hot it was outside.
Yeah.
Is it? Because he saw it on the news? Because he saw it on the newspaper?
Right. Are you ready to jump into this philosophy? I always transition with the jump in. You want to jump in?
Yeah, it's always a good transition to transition. So, you ready for the next thing?
Especially when it's this hot out. Jump in sounds good because it almost reminds you of a swimming pool, right?
Yeah.
The philosopher we're going to be discussing today is Albert Camus. Do you know anything about him, first of all?
No, I know that the last name needs work. Yes, you're famous. Yes, you were brilliant. Yes, okay, you're French or something.
Right.
But, yeah, Camus, Albert Camus. It's fine with me, but I don't know anything about his work or what he thought or how he put it.
But the last name, you're not thrilled with it right now.
I need to sit down with him and talk about the name.
Right, okay. Something with a better ring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Camus, it's not working for you. Is it the moo?
I think so. I think the Camulet would be better. But that's it. I can't sit down with him. So let's just proceed. Yeah.
You missed your chance for that. Well, Alex was talking about how you suffered an injury yourself in 2012.
Yes.
I remember on your podcast you took quite a leave of absence when you hurt your head.
I walked out of a small building. Okay, it was a bar. But you know what? I'm the luckiest guy in the world. People talk about this. They talk about getting touched, getting saved. Well, I could have died. I wasn't loaded, and I fell on the sidewalk. I've never done that before. Hit my head on the concrete, and you know what? People die from that. And there were folks outside there who had been in the bar, and they helped me get up, and they said, "You all right?" And I said, "Yeah, fine." But I could see their faces looking at me, and their faces said, "He's not fine."
What prompted the fall? Do you know?
No, you know what? Oh, I don't know. Maybe I had, maybe I slipped on something. But there's nothing to slip on outside of a bar. It sounds idiotic, but I mean, there's nothing. It's not like, it's not a place that has suddenly Tinker Toys, you know, where you're going to slip on something. But I did. You can lean back against the wall of the bar, which is made of stones.
Mm-hmm.
And those are sharp. But the main thing is, and I went back into the bar, they said, you should call the ambulance. I said, well, okay.
One more drink, though.
Yeah.
You did?
Essentially. Well, right. I went back in to order, and I was going to call the ambulance from the bar. I had my phone with me. And bartender, Patrick, came up, and he said, everything all right, Larry? I said, yeah, do me a favor. Let me have one more drink, and let me have the chicken dinner, too, please, here at the bar. And then I glanced at his face. Now, this is maybe the toughest bartender I've ever known. And fair, a great fella.
And you knew Valley Stream bartenders, and I know those guys are tough. I've been,
they
been
were pretty
to,
tough.
Been to quite a few bars in Valley
they
Stream.
They were pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
But this guy was really tough. This guy knew how to, he had his hand, always had his hand on a pig sticker behind that bar, and, but he was tough.
What does that mean? I don't know. What's a pig sticker?
Well, if you're going to kill a pig, isn't it wonderful how shows go, by the way?
Yeah.
But you could have, say a small spear, or it could be a wooden club with a nail in it, with the pointy end coming out.
And that's how you'd kill it. Oh, so you'd stick it into the pig. See, my mind went right away to a sticker that you might paste in the shape of a pig. A pig's face sticker. That doesn't sound terribly tough to me.
And the pig, no. And when the pig can see that on the door of the bar coming in. No smoking, no dancing. And, they have pig stickers.
They have pig stickers.
But he also said to me when I, I ordered the drink and I said, I want to call, I'm going to call an ambulance. And I looked at his face and he was looking at me. And he just immediately said, Larry, if I were you, I'd call that ambulance right now. And I said, glad you said it. And I just did that. I called the ambulance right there because I cracked my head open. It was on top and in the back, and I cracked it like a walnut.
Wow.
And I could have died right there.
You don't suspect any foul play that someone pushed you over or something and you blocked it out?
I always suspect foul play.
Good.
But no, I didn't suspect anything, and I knew that I had fallen, and I knew that I had cracked my head open now, and the ambulance came. This is the kind of bar where it's tough. It's so tough that the ambulance is on the side. Mm-hmm. It's on the side street. It's that close. And they were great. I called my friend. I was embarrassed. And my wife, I was embarrassed just to call my wife.
Why?
Why?
Yeah, why?
Because then the first thing she's going to think is, you are stupid. I was right all this whole time.
Really?
Well, I was embarrassed. And so my friend...
was it like a macho thing? Like, I'm a guy, I shouldn't be, I shouldn't be so vulnerable to falling. And
No.
So what's embarrassing about it?
It's just part of marriage. It's not a bad part of marriage. It keeps men honest sometimes, just to know, bonehead, you have to...
Bonehead.
Yeah, exactly right. But you have to pay for what you buy. And so they took me. I got in the ambulance. I called my friend, got in the ambulance, and they took me to great Alfred, the UCLA Brain Therapy Center, which is number one in the country, in the world or something. It's the Ronald Reagan Medical Center or something. And you know what? I was very lucky. My wife was there. She was my champion the whole time. I was in that hospital for 4 weeks. And... When they put you in a coma, They do this intentionally. That's part of what happens. They put you into a coma, and then take the top of your head off in big pieces to let the brain heal, if it's going to heal. And it has to swell a little bit, so you're in intensive care.
Wow.
And I was there, I was in a coma for 10 days, and then I came out. It was really great, because my wife, as tough as she is, as a champ, this is absolutely true. You know, at the end of that, at the 10th day, there was no sign that I was getting better. There was no sign of anything. She went back that night, and she'd pick up the kids from school. She'd take them to school in the morning. She'd do everything. And she came back into the house and was ready for sleep, and it was about midnight, and she walked out onto the balcony behind our bedroom there and yelled at God. She was so mad, she just screamed, "Heal him now or take him now, but I can't take this anymore." And the next day, she got to the hospital after taking the kids to school, and the doctor there that we really liked, he came up to her and said, "Good news today, Mrs. Miller. Larry came out of the coma. He's still very fuzzy, but I think he's going to make it now. I think the brain is going to heal, and I think it's going to be okay." And this is completely true. And she started crying, and he said, "Oh, are you crying because you're happy?" And she said, "No, it's because he had said to her, 'Did this happen at any time around midnight last night?'" And he said, "Well, that's funny you ask. It happened exactly at midnight last night." And he said to her, "Was that when you were yelling at God?" And she just looked at him, and he said, "All the wives do it eventually. They just get really consumed with their fear, and they yell at God." She said, "They all do?" He said, "Yes." And that's when she started to cry. And he said, "Are you crying because you're happy that your husband is going to survive?" And she said, "No, I'm crying because I didn't ask for new furniture at the same time. Should have asked for things, if he's listening."
Yeah.
And so she, in fact, it was very, very joyous. And
she went home that night and yelled to God, "So you went with heal him, huh?"
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, she walked down the balcony and said, "Okay, one more thing." But that's what happened. The doctor took her over to my bed there in intensive care and said, "I was out cold." And he said, "Larry, Eileen is here now." And she said, "Hi." And he said to her, "Would you give her a sign with one of your hands that you're listening and you know what's going on?" And I gave her a thumbs up. And she started to tear up again. And the doctor said, "Okay, you know, how do we do this? Now please give her another sign with the other hand that's different from what you just did." And I gave her with the other hand a V for victory sign.
Nice.
And she walked up to the doctor before she was leaving that day. And she said, "Doctor, I'm just curious. Do any of the patients ever just give one sign, like one finger, you know, like say a middle finger up like that?" And he said, "Oh, they all do." And she started to smile. And then he said, "But those are always the patients that die." And she looked at him because, well, she's a comedy writer and a producer. And she's wondering, looking at this guy, and she realized he's not kidding. And this is not a joke time.
This leaves me with so many questions.
Sure.
The first of them being, the bartender that night, did he keep the chicken dinner warm?
You know, that's very funny, because we'd still be there 2 years later.
"I still got that dinner for you if you like it.
Dinner if you want it."
With the story you told me, it must have definitely affected you and your wife's faith and how you feel about God. And
anything should affect that faith. Anything we do in our lives should affect how you look at the larger context of life. In my case, it just made it, underlined it more. I was dead. I died. And I went up, but I didn't get wings, didn't see my parents, relatives, anything like that. I was taken right to God's office, and he let me have it. He thought this was really stupid. And that I didn't accomplish what he sent me for. And he said, this is what you're supposed to write more, be funny, go down, have people listen to you, tell them what you think of life. But you have to ask first. You have to apologize to me, and then you have to really ask, and you have to ask well. And I did. And so he sent me back to, but with the general instruction of, not yet. So and if you're asking me, well, that's a pretty good statement right there. It doesn't mean, well, maybe you were just out of it and just seeing light.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not.
Right.
And so I don't tell people this. It's not like I'm standing on a street corner. But that's the answer to that one. People say, you know what? Well, I don't. It's funny. Even older people, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, used to say, well, I don't know if I believe in God. And then someone else in the tribe could just say, really? Because he's right behind you. You know, he brought all the other stuff. I mean, that's him right there. You could turn around and look. Well, that's not the way we are today. And the people who are most vocal about their beliefs are sometimes very angry about it. And like the folks who knocked down the World Trade Centers and murdered a lot of people.
Do you think that's based on belief in God or there's a different agenda there?
Well, I think they're wrong. Maybe that's an odd way to put it, but yeah, I think that's wrong. You can't just say you believe in something and then go steal 400 girls from a high school and take them back to your little village.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't then say, oh, thank you, God. I don't think God is saying you're welcome. I think God's going to have a very interesting meeting with you that you and I would like to be a fly on the wall.
So tell me about you. You were about to say how it affected your faith.
Well, I get up in the morning and I walk with the dog before I wake the kids up for school and my wife is sleeping. And the first thing I always do now, always, is say, thank you for bringing me back for another day. This is great. I can look out the windows in the living room and just say, it looks like another beautiful day you made. It's a little, is it misty? Is it rainy? It's still beautiful to me.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you because I'm glad you gave me another day. And today I knew I was going to, well, work out a little, then shower, shave, come here to see you.
So it's given you a deeper appreciation for every moment, is what you're telling me.
Yes, and especially for the ones we're here for. Again, you and me and people like us. It's good to be a storyteller. That's a great thing to bring into the world. It's good to have people listen. And laughter, when it's good laughter, when is very deep, it's not just frothy and something that gets tossed away. If someone is a good storyteller and it brings humor into the world, I think these are very important things and very valuable things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think much more valuable than, getting your taxes done, and those things are all important. But being a good comic, good actor, good writer, that's why I was made, that's why I was sent here, and that's what I'm doing. And I'm going to do better every day.
Before this had happened, were you taking for granted the fact that you were a comedian?
No, never. But the difference between 8 and 9 is actually huge on anything, but especially, good Lord, the whole concept of, you know, how this neighborhood got here, why everything exists. Well, that going from one number to another is huge. And
can you elaborate on that, what that means?
Well, there's no room for doubt anymore. When people say, I'm not sure what I believe in, I can say, I am. And you know what? I think it's good to feel that way, to know that, well, I'm going to have a good hug with my parents one day.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully not for a long time, but the same thing with all relatives, the ones you haven't met yet, who are standing there smiling too. I think if you make it, if you get in to the big club, I think you're going to have a lot of good hugs. and those will be very meaningful.
And going back to how you've changed your life, you said when you were up there and you were talking to God, you said, I'm not doing what I was put here to do. What specifically were you referring to that you weren't doing?
I wasn't the one saying that. I was, you know, I was told.
You were being told that. So what were you, what was it in reference to?
Everything we do. The same thing, writing, performing, storytelling,
you were being lackadaisical about it? Or
no, that I wasn't doing enough. That I need to do, I was made to do a lot more. By enough, that doesn't necessarily mean being a star in movies and winning an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
It does for me. But I mean, there's a million miles more to go, even with everyone. The pictures you have on the walls here, of all these fabulous comedians and actors. Just to say to folks, for goodness sake, to have George Carlin, Bill Cosby, Don Rickles, Rodney Dangerfield, Jonathan Winters, mm-hmm. Walter Matthau just going down the line here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for goodness sake, they did huge work.
So what do you attribute the fact that you weren't doing huge work to before this happened?
I can always do more, and so can you. There is still a lot we do. Everyone listening to this knows that most every day, your first instinct is to say, maybe I'll just watch some more TV.
Was it laziness, or you're just...
You know what, though? It's interesting that you're asking, looking for an image or a word, but I'm telling you,
right.
I'm here to tell you, you won't understand it. It's not that it's so deep and so wordy, but it's pretty great to know. It's like a variation of what's love. How do you know when someone loves you? Well, you do. And you know what? If you have to keep asking someone, it doesn't help the love. Now, does that love change? Yes. Does it bring out darker colors and, well, I hate you today? Sure it does. But there's nothing wrong with that in life. We don't always have to go skipping along every day. And that's what's changed in me. You know what? I know where I'm going. I don't want to go there for a long time. And to get there, the questions are going to be, well, what did you do? What did you accomplish? Did you get everything? Did you squeeze every drop I gave you? You want to be able to say yes to that question.
I started studying Talmud every week. And the thing I was actually just studying this week is a piece of the Talmud where it talks about how the only thing God won't forgive when you die is wasted time.
Wow, that's a great way to put it.
So,
well, good place to get it.
It's interesting to hear this the same week that I was just learning about this. But
yeah,
from somebody who seemed to have learned it firsthand.
It's a wonderful way to put it. What worse could there be? If you're not talking about the greatest sins in the world, good Lord, the murder, the, you know, the kidnapping, the whatever people are doing that they're just horrible on, awful people, and if you get past all that and saying what are the biggest problems, what are the biggest sins, and I think that's a good one, wasted time.
It's the only thing that you can't repent for.
Boy, that's a terrific way to put it, and you can't repent for that. How do you like that? I think that's a pretty sharp way to think about it.
Well, let's take a look at someone who has a different look at all this, and that is our guy Albert Camus, who I know has a different look at this because I know a little bit about him. Usually I go into these blind, but I do know a little bit about him, and I know that he was not a big believer in meaning. In life. Let's see. Camus is called an existentialist, yet he never liked the title. He believed that life is about mortality and that happiness is fleeting. Things cannot have meaning if we die, and the sum explodes, because death erases everything. Well, that's pretty contrary to what we're talking about right now.
Yeah, it is.
How do we deal with this? We would be happier if we decide we have meaning. But this is just us placating to ourselves. Should we kill ourselves?
Yeah, that's not something you should do. And It's not a good thing. And I think fellas like Camus and these people, good luck to them and all, but I think they were from a part of a culture and a time and civilization where everyone, all the smarter people, especially as writers, were thinking, you know what, let's believe in other things. The cool people, more of the showmakers, plays and music, were never going to, or almost never going to be born or growing into a sense that it doesn't vanish. It doesn't. This is right now, this is a great chance to use our bodies, and then when those are done, to move on. Where? You know where, but it's not sophisticated for a lot of those folks to say that. I'm not making fun of him. I'm saying, all right,
sure,
that's what you thought. I'm sure all your friends and colleagues thought the same thing. It's not what I think. It's not what I believe. And now it's, well, not what I know. That, no, it's still good to say, let me do this right now. Do this writing, do this working, do this performing. Not just because I'm moved to do it and I have nothing else to do, and no matter what, it all stinks and nothing has any meaning, but because it all has meaning. The better I do it, the farther I go, here and there. If I do what I was made to do, you too, and everyone listening, it doesn't mean just in show business. It means everything. If you take your kids and learn them how to throw a baseball better, teach them how to be a better ball player. Not the best ball player in the world, but to do that, to say, you know what, I was going to sit down in this big bed and watch an old movie or read a book, but you know what let's do instead? You and I just pick a kid and say, let's go out and get a bite right now, or just walk down the boulevard.
Mm-hmm.
Just together. You don't have to talk about anything specific, but being together has tremendous value, and that helps you. That doesn't go for nothing. That doesn't go for nothing for you or for the child. It goes for everything. And does it get noticed? Of course it does. And you just noticed it yourself by doing it. These things have great value. That's what the best thing in the world to me is, to realize they have huge value. They don't exist on their own and then just get frittered away or just burn and then just go up like smoke rings. No, they don't. You don't either. And if you're creative, if you're a philosopher, if you're an artist, if you're a thinker, if you're a storyteller, all your work gets better too. Having those extra colors in it makes it better. Makes it deeper, makes it worth so much more, not only to the folks who are hearing it when you wrote it, when you're creating it, not just to you, to everything. And it doesn't go away, stays forever.
Every move counts.
Everything.
Well, let's go back to our opposing opinion. Camus says, should we kill ourselves? This would not help, because we would be trying to kill the absurdity of life, which is impossible. Camus concludes that we must live our lives to the fullest, well, same conclusion, for a different reason, because they will end, and otherwise we didn't have fun on our way to death. His reason's different, but he's still come to the conclusion to maximize living your life to the fullest, doing the most, maybe for in a different way.
Yeah, but I might say to him, again, good luck to him. Maybe he and I will have a chat someday. But I might say to him, you were wrong, though, because it's not great fun to do on your way to death, where everything is nothing. It's great fun to do because you're building something, like all the old images. You're building a wall, a good wall. You're building a home, a castle.
Why'd you pick a wall?
Well, it's because of what surrounds homes. And castles, I
guess.
But
I always, because I go back to the Western Wall in my head, I always wonder, you know, people, a wall could mean a lot or almost nothing, you know, depend.
Well, they all mean a lot in a way, and especially the one, that wall is still there. It's very meaningful.
Right.
It's what's on top of it, what's around it. You know, the some very bad people on top of it. But I'm just saying that that wall is still there. And that wall is still smiling at you and saying, still here. And there's a reason we're still here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Camus, when you talk to him, you'll have to talk to him in the next dimension. He died in 1960. He lived from November 7th, 1913 to January 4th, 1960. He was a French Nobel Prize winning author, a journalist, and a philosopher. His views contributed to the rise of the philosophy known as absurdism. He wrote in his essay, The Rebel, that his whole life was devoted to opposing the philosophy of nihilism while still delving deeply into individual and sexual freedom. He didn't consider himself an existentialist, as I mentioned, despite usually being classified as one. In an interview in 1945, he rejected any ideological associations. He says, no, I'm not an existentialist. Sartre and I are always surprised to see our names linked. He was born in French Algeria to a Pied Noir family. I don't know what that means.
Pied Noir?
Pied Noir. What is that?
Well, I think literally it means black feet. I could be wrong, though.
Hmm. To a black-footed family?
Well, that's... I think Algeria was the right place for that.
He studied at the University of Algiers, where he was a goalkeeper for the university's football team, until he contracted tuberculosis in 1930. In 1949, he founded the Group of International Liaisons with the Revolutionary Union Movement after his split with Gary Davis, Citizens of the World Movement. I don't know about that either. The formation of this group, according to Campus, was intended to denounce two ideologies found in both the USSR and the USA regarding their idolatry of technology. He was married twice. The first time his marriage ended because both he and his wife were being unfaithful to each other. He was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1957 for his important literary production, with which clear-sighted earnestness illuminates from the problems of the human conscious in our times.
It's funny, whenever I hear about these guys like Camus, and you say, well, he died in 1960 and he was born in 1913, first thing I do is say, well, that's 47 years.
Yeah, he was young.
They were also young.
Well, he died in a car accident when he was 46, near Sens, I don't know if that's pronounced right either, in Le Grand Forçade, in a small town of Villeblevin. I don't even know where that is. But he died in a car accident, is the point. In his coat pocket was an unused train ticket. He had planned to travel by train with his wife and children, but at the last minute, he accepted his publisher's proposal to travel with him. Well, there's a turn in fate right there.
Yeah, and... plus, you want to say, unless there's something, well, really horrible up or something valuable yet, we have to talk about this deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that ever happens, but no, go with your wife and kids. If Bill, your publisher, calls up and says, no, come with me, you should say, you know what? No, I'm going to go with my wife and kids, and we'll look out the window together, and we'll point to the cows.
And you would have still been around.
Not only that, but that would have brought more light into the world. It has a big beam in it, the whole concept of family. We sometimes forget that.
Sometimes I wonder when I'm reading about these philosophers, what if they'd lived longer, would their philosophy have changed with their experiences and with their life, such as what happened with you and your near-death experience? God forbid you died before that happened, the story of Larry Miller would be very different at the end. Are you happy that it happened looking back now?
Sure. I'm thrilled. It gave me so much to bank on, to invest in myself and to realize and in my family and the whole point of being here. Well, sure. Thank God. I'm fine. I'm healthy and I'm going to keep getting better and better. And yeah, if it didn't happen, well, I wouldn't have this extra shine. I'm glad I do.
So that's interesting. Ultimately, it was a good thing.
Yes. It was a fabulous thing. It something that moves you forward with a big tap on the shoulder and a big finger pointing, go, get it done. I'm just thrilled it happened and that it shook everything up.
Fair enough. I can understand that. Well, what we have left here is a bit of Camus' philosophy, some of the stuff to actually read some of his writing, and I would ask you to do the honors if you don't mind.
Sure. Here we go, folks. I don't know whether this world has a meaning that transcends it, but I know that I cannot know that meaning and that it is impossible for me just now to know it. What can a meaning outside my condition mean to me? I can understand only in human terms. What I touch, what resists me, that I understand. And these two certainties, my appetite for the absolute and for unity, and the possibility of reducing this world to a rational and reasonable principle. I also know that I cannot reconcile them. What other truth can I admit without lying, without bringing in a hope I lack, and which means nothing within the limits of my conditions? That was the end of that paragraph.
Oh, okay. Basically, he's saying is I'm doing the best I could do with what I've got, information-wise.
Well, that one sentence would have done better than this paragraph, I think. I'm doing the best with what I have.
But that's what I got out of it, is this is the information I have. I can only understand as much as I can as a human. I don't want to lie to you guys. This is what I got.
His first sentence is good. I don't know whether this world has a meaning that transcends it. Well, it does. But I like the way he says, I don't know that. But I know, he says, that I cannot know that meaning and that it is impossible for me just now to know it. Well, he's right too. He cannot know that meaning and that it is impossible for him, at that second he was thinking this and writing it, to know it. Well, that's why he wasn't big on the concept of leap of faith,
mm-hmm,
or anything associated that way. How do you know it's there? Well, it is. Yeah, but how? Can you prove it? No.
I think you have to open yourself up to these things, too. And I think a lot of people who have a hard time with it, they don't actually allow themselves the room to try and live within that other understanding. I've had times when I couldn't open myself up to it, and struggles where I forced myself to say, you know what? This doesn't make sense to me, but I'm going to try and just be open to it for a little while. And if it still doesn't make sense to me, I'll back out. And in that window of time, I think I gained a much deeper understanding of these things. But if you don't give yourself that opportunity, it's like anything. If you're stuck in one way of thinking and you don't give yourself the flexibility and the openness to look at something else, you may never see it.
I think I agree with you. Plus, I would tell people who, you know what, just do it. Just believe. What does it hurt you? And if it turns out nothing exists after life, well, so what? So you haven't lost anything. But if it does, you're way ahead on points. And that first meeting gets, you can say, by the way, I notice you have my file in front of you, and it's a lot thicker than I thought it would be, but I'm just saying that I was with you the whole way, and I hope that has an effect. All right, here are the quotes. You will never be happy if you continue to search for what happiness consists of. You will never live if you are looking for the meaning of life. I like that, though. You will never be happy if you continue to search for what happiness consists of. That is not happiness. You don't get to say, no, look, it's great. We if we live another year, Let's think of the things we can do. No, don't do that. Get up every day, smile and say thank you, and then go make some coffee. Just live that way.
Unless you're Mormon.
Well, unless you're not allowed to drink coffee. You will never live if you are looking for the meaning of life. That's right. Don't look for it. You know what? It's a great secret that's kind of hidden. You are the meaning to life. You already are.
Me?
Yes, you specifically. No one else. Everyone here listening, you are already the meaning of life. There's nothing to look for except yourself.
So the world does revolve around me.
Yes.
Huh.
But not if you think it does. Okay, here's the second one. But what is happiness except the simple harmony between a man and the life he leads? I think that's a good point. What is happiness except the simple harmony between a man and the life he leads? That's the second-to-second, day-to-day sense of living life. Not looking for that meaning. Not looking for what to do. It's right there in front of you anyway. What should I do right now? Clear the dishes.
Now I got two people telling me that. Upstairs and downstairs. That must mean something. If I've got clean the dishes coming from the guest and by my girlfriend, they better do those damn
number
dishes.
Number two. The number one from the guest is air conditioning.
Yeah.
All right, here's number three. The only way to deal with an unfree world is to become so absolutely free that your very existence is an act of rebellion. Boy, I think that's true. I think that's great. I remember, who was the great writer who's free now? He was imprisoned. He was a Jewish writer in the Soviet Union. Well, but he was saying when he was a prisoner, and it was a long time in many different prisons. I think he, in fact, wrote the Gulag Archipelago. But regardless, he knew and he said and he wrote, and I read this, that his act of rebellion, as Camus' line here is, his act of rebellion always was when he was told by his jailers, and they were not going to treat him well. They wouldn't let him sleep. They wouldn't let him do this. But when he was told to go from his cell to the questioning room, whatever it was, he would, instead of just walking out the door, he would, in that jail cell, take a quick step to the left, a quick one forward, and a quick step to the right, and then walk out. And he said, that was my act of rebellion, of just doing something more personal and independent, and it was mine. Mm-hmm. I made that moment mine in life.
Is this who you were, the name you were looking for? Is it Alexander
Solzhenitsyn?
Solzhenitsyn.
Yes. And so, you know what, folks? That's a good thought for us to leave on today. There have been, I think, a lot of good thoughts today, but the only way to deal with an unfree world, a horrible world, a world of so much horror, and the only way is to become so absolutely free yourself in every action you have, to be conscious of it and smile through it and say, how do you like that? Look at what I'm doing now and choosing to do, and that your very existence is an act of rebellion.
I'm a rebel.
You know what? More than you think.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. My show, if you want to give it a try, is This Week with Larry Miller.
I highly recommend it. I love it. And I don't listen to too many podcasts. Mostly just spend my time making this one. But I find yours to be fantastic.
Thank you, pal. And you know what? I think the same about yours.
Well, thank you very much. I guess I will go back to what I do best, which is hanging out in front of the house with the chicken for the remainder of the day and trying to make the most of it every second.
I think I'll get back to say goodbye to you and your girlfriend and everybody in the house and to the animals, and then get in my car and turn the air conditioning on.
I feel bad, but you know what? You'll appreciate it a lot more now. At least I'll give you that. In the same way that maybe you appreciate life more since what happened with the accident, you'll appreciate air conditioning a lot more after doing this show.
I'm going to give you that. It's a better way to leave to say, you know what? Maybe you're right.
Thanks, Larry. My special thanks to our guest, Larry Miller. My thanks to you guys, the listeners, for tuning in. That is our show. That's it. We'll see you next week. We've got another wonderful guest lined up. It's a good season. I'm pumped. I'm excited that you're listening. Please go to the website, moderndayphilosophers.net, and make a donation. If you donate $20 or more, there's still a few pairs left. I can send you some tweaked audio earbuds. Tweaked audio earbuds will show up in the mail as a reward for a $20 or larger donation. Please do so. I could use the help. And if you just want to get some Tweaked Audio earbuds, you can go to their website, tweakedaudio.com, put in the promo code MDP, short for Modern Day Philosophers, and you will get 1/3 off, plus free shipping, and a lifetime warranty or guarantee. It's one of those. But for your whole life, they're with you in some capacity. Okay. That's it. You want to help the show other ways? Jump on iTunes, leave a nice comment, 5 stars. Besides the fact that I read them all and it makes me feel good, it also helps the show's visibility on iTunes. And if you've done it before, you can do it again. You can do it as many times as you like. Tell your friends to do it. Tell their friends to do it. That's about enough of that. Okay, so you could do that. You go to the website, you can make a donation, and you can always email me at thecomical@yahoo.com and say hello. I love hearing from the listeners. I love hearing from you. Please do that. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next week with another fantastic episode of Modern Day Philosophers. Goodbye.